Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 45. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Before we jump into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast. I'm so grateful for your encouragement and generosity. You can find a full list of patrons on my website under the Patrons tab. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. September's prize is a digital download of the album Elizabeth by Carlene, inspired by the life of Elizabeth I. I'll play you a song from this wonderful album very soon. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about mudlarking is Lara Makelam. Lara has been fossicking since she was a child, growing up on her family's farm just beyond the reach of London's grimy clutches. It was a habit she took with her when she finally succumbed to the bright lights of the city in the early 1990s, and what eventually led her down to the foreshore of the River Thames. Her obsession with mudlarking and subsequent collection of weird and wonderful objects grew steadily over the years, and in 2012, just after the birth of her twins, she began sharing her finds and exploits on Facebook under the name of London Mudlark. She now shares the hidden side of one of the world's most famous rivers with thousands of people all around the world. In 2015, she followed the Thames out of London and now lives on the Kent coast within easy reach of the river, which she visits as regularly as the tide permits. Mudlarking, Lost and Found on the River Thames is her first book. My conversation with Lara straight after this musical break, courtesy of singer-songwriter Carlene. The song Elizabeth is from Carlene's album entitled Elizabeth.
I, sapphire blue, pale skin like the moon, a crown of fire and gold. She will be loved, this I know to be true. My I, sapphire blue, pale skin like the moon, a crown of fire and gold. She will be loved, this I know to be true, Lady Elizabeth. They'll travel so far to revere and admire, daughter of fire and gold. She will be loved, she will rouse and inspire, Lady Elizabeth.
Thank you.
welcome to Talking Tunes, Lara. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
That's great. It's lovely to have you on the show. Now, I thought we could begin by you just telling us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I lived in London for around about 25 years. I moved out about 5 years ago because I've got twins and because basically we grew out of our tiny little London house. But for 25 years, I developed a very deep and personal connection with the River Thames that eventually took me down onto its foreshore, searching for history.
That sounds wonderful. And I have to congratulate you on the recent publication of your book, which is called Mudlarking, Lost and Found on the River Thames. Now, for our listeners that maybe haven't heard of mudlarking before, what exactly is it?
Mudlarking is the Thames is tidal, so twice a day the waters fall and it reveals the foreshore, which is basically the riverbed. And for a few hours a day, you get the chance to go down onto the riverbed and search around for history. Now, the Thames has been used as a rubbish dump, as a place for votive offerings, as a place where people have lost things. It was once a very, very busy highway. And so, as you can imagine, there's loads and loads of stuff in the river, and every tide reveals something different. So it's a bit of a treasure hunt, and it's obsessive because you never know what you're going to find day to day.
It sounds like a history lover's dream, I have to say. Now, how did you first become involved in mudlarking?
It evolved over time. As I say, I moved to London. I was desperate to get to the city, and I grew up in the countryside, desperate to get to the city, away from the mud and the quiet. And I got to the city, absolutely loved it, but I needed somewhere quiet to go. I missed the countryside, and I looked and looked for somewhere quiet, and I found myself down by the river. And for years, I just walked along it, and I just enjoyed the peace and quiet. Nobody really went down there. You can walk for miles along the river path. And I never really thought to myself, a lot of Londoners, they live in London their entire lives and don't realise that the river goes up and down. And they don't realise that you can actually go down onto the riverbed. And I was the same. I over time, I sort of worked out that this body of water was moving and going up and down. And then one day I found myself at the top of a set of stairs and I was looking at the foreshore and I thought, well, there's no reason why I can't go down there. I'll just go down and take a look. And I went down, and that day I found a clay pipe stem. That was the first thing I found. And I knew what it was because I grew up in a very old house. And when I was little, I spent my time digging around in the garden bed for things like clay pipes and pottery shards and things like that. So I knew what it was, and it stood to reason that there was more there. So I went back the next day and I found a little bit more, and I carried on going back. And that was just over 15 years ago, and I haven't stopped.
Yeah, I've just got a big smile on my face listening to you. It sounds so, so wonderful. I love it. Now, could you talk to us a little bit about the history of mudlarking? Like, when and why did people start scouring the banks of the Thames?
I think there's probably been river scavengers searching for whatever they can use or sell on the river ever since London was established by the Romans 2,000 years ago. I mean, there's always people looking for things that people have lost. The very first time they're mentioned, though, or that I've found them mentioned, is the end of the 18th century in a book by Patrick Culhoun. He was the man that set up the Thames River Police, and he essentially set up the River Police as an organisation to protect the ships that were coming in from the West Indies with very valuable imports on them, spices and sugar and rum. And there were gangs of criminals that would go aboard and just steal whatever they wanted to. And he mentioned the mudlarks among the scuffle hunters and all sorts of other wonderfully named groups as one of these criminal gangs. And they were the people who hung around in the mud around the hulls of the ships, waiting for the packages that were thrown off by other criminals. And then they would take them to the pubs in Wapping, maybe, where they were fenced on into the black market. But even then, the mudlarks were the lowest of the low. They were real low life criminals, and nobody had a great deal of respect for them. But the mudlarks really started coming to the fore and being written about in the 19th century, when social reformers and social commentators like Patrick Mayhew started to write about them and describe them. And you can find an awful lot of 19th century literature where people are describing these bands of pathetic creatures that roamed the riverbed at low tide. And they were usually children or old people. They were the very lowest in society, the sort of people who couldn't earn a living any other way, who went down there to to look for anything they could use or find. So they were looking for rags and a rope and bones to sell to the glue factory, perhaps the old copper nail, bits of coal, absolutely anything. And that was the only thing that kept them out of the workhouse. So to think that going down, and I mean, the river at that time was just a moving cesspit. It was filthy. It was disgusting. And to think that wading around in all of that was preferable to going into the workhouse just gives you some idea of how horrific the workhouses were at the time.
Yeah, that's intriguing. Now, you mentioned earlier that the Thames was a bit of a dumping ground and it's, you know, been a highway as well. Can you talk to us a little bit more about this, you know, this key role, this pivotal role that the Thames has played in the history of London?
London's only there because of the Thames. You know, the Romans arrived, they found this body of water that they could sail up. And so the Romans came up the Thames, Thamesis, and they founded London on its banks because they could get out to the sea quite easily, and then they had access to the rest of the empire. And so it grew from there. Obviously, there would have been bands of hunters and gatherers before then, and probably, though there's no actual evidence, probably small settlements, sort of Bronze Age, Iron Age settlements alongside the river. But it was the Romans that really founded the city. And since then, it's been used as a convenient place to dump the city's rubbish. It was a really busy highway when obviously the roads were just dirt tracks and were really difficult to move around on. It was much quicker to go up and down and across on the river. And then later on in the 18th century, when London became the biggest port in the world, the river brought ships from everywhere, every corner of the globe, you know, including Australia. So, you know, it's connected London to the world, and it's formed London because it's brought the world into London and created this uniquely cosmopolitan city.
Yeah, definitely the heart of London, I think, for sure. Now, Lara, I want to hear more about how you actually go about doing the mudlarking. So do you use any equipment when you're looking for these beautiful artifacts?
I don't. The first thing you need when you go mudlarking is a permit. And you get your permit from the Port of London Authority. Anybody can apply for a permit, but it's important to have a permit. That's what's protecting the foreshore. And so once you've got your permit, you can go down there, and you're allowed with a permit dig or scrape down to a certain just a few inches and metal detect in certain areas. There are protected areas. I don't use a metal detector, and I don't dig and I don't scrape. Everything I find just lying on the surface, because for me, that's part of what I do. It's I like to just collect what the river has chosen to leave for me on that tide. As far as I'm concerned, if something's buried, it's safe until it's revealed again. So I would rather leave things that are under the mud where they are and just collect what's there on the surface. So it's just a case of a lot of time, a lot of patience, getting your eye in. I look for circles and straight lines that don't fit with nature, because nature doesn't make perfect circles and perfect straight lines. So anything that stands out and doesn't quite fit with its surroundings, and your eye just gets attuned to it. Some people pick it up really quickly, and some people never pick it up. And it really is just a case of practice. It's not something, unless you're incredibly lucky and you go down and you find the most wonderful thing your first time you go, it's something that's going to take a few trips to really attune.
Yeah, I saw one of the photos I think that you posted recently of just if anyone could spot something, and I was so proud that I actually saw I think it's like the first time that I thought, oh look, I can see something. So that was really fun, really exciting. Now, you mentioned you've spent more than 15 years mudlarking on the Thames. I want to hear some of the great finds that you've had in that time. Could you tell us about some of those?
The wonder of the Thames is that you just never know what's going to turn up. I found a really beautiful Roman melon bead, literally washed up right next to my boot while I was standing next to the river. I found an ivory Roman sword shape that would have belonged to an auxiliary soldier, and it's only one of only two complete examples that have been found in the country. I found glass linen smoother, which made me realise that I'm ashamed that I don't do ironing, because apparently these linen smoothers have been around since Viking times. So if a Viking can manage to smooth their linen, you know, why can't I? I have found beads, trade beads. They fascinate me because the history behind them. You find this little tiny piece of glass that would have been destined probably for West Africa, exchanged for a human life, and that person would have been taken over to the Caribbean to grow the sugar that was then brought back to London in barrels to turn into cones of sugar. You find shards of the molds from these sugar cones on the foreshore, and also rum. So there's evidence of that triangle trade, which is fascinating. I mean, I could go on forever. Some of the weirdest stuff I found a box of human ashes. Somebody had just rather than taking the lid off and tipping them in, they'd just thrown the whole box in, which was a bit, left me in a bit of a moral dilemma as to what to do with them, because yeah. they'd washed up with all the rest of the rubbish. Recently, I found a complete Iron Age pot just lying on the surface of the river. I'm not going into my Tudor finds, because I think we'll talk about those later, won't
yes.
we?
Yes, yes.
A human skull,
wow.
Found fairly recently as well, that we think is probably from the prison hulks where they kept the people who were destined for the colonies for transportation, and also prisoners of war from the Napoleonic era. And they were kept on these horrific vessels that were moored on the Thames. And when they, obviously, if there was disease on board, it went around terribly quickly. They were really badly fed. They were living in these dreadful conditions. Loads of people died. When they died, they just row them to the nearest bit of land and bury them in a shallow grave. And now these are eroding out, and the bones are falling onto the foreshore. So it's not unusual to find human bones on the river, but finding a skull, complete skull, was quite thought-provoking. And I obviously reported that to the police, as you have to do with all human remains. So, I mean, my list is endless.
That's extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. I can't believe that that's all. What an amazing archaeological site that river is. It's just mind-boggling.
It is, because it's, you know, we're still contributing to it, although, albeit plastic.
Yeah.
We are the plastic age, but we are still contributing to it. You know, we're throwing, still, people are still throwing coins in. People have been making offerings to the Thames since time began. So, you know, these votive offerings are going in. You find bent, I've never found one, but a bent Bronze Age swords and weapons have been found that were offered. Lots of Roman coins, I found quite a lot of them. And even today, London's Hindu community use the river as a substitute for the Ganges. So you find a lot of Hindu offerings at the moment. So, you know, the Thames is still very much a part of, central part of London life.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. So fascinating. Okay, I'd love now to hear about some of your Tudor artifacts that you've found over the years.
I have to say, medieval and Tudor objects are my goal. These are the things I really look for. I found lots of Roman stuff. The Romans seem to scatter stuff everywhere. Lots of Georgian stuff, but it's the medieval and the Tudor stuff that I look for. And I haven't found so much of it. I found a lot of shards of pottery, that lovely green glaze. I've got quite a lot of the little tops from money boxes. They're those little green, they're about the size of an orange with a slit down the side. And I found quite a lot of those on Bankside, which is near the Globe Theatre, which is where the theatre as well. And I love those because I love to imagine them being carried around in the theatres, the original Globe, and people pushing their little pennies in and actually watching one of Shakespeare's plays. You know, maybe he was there in person. I've got a complete one that was found at Bankside in the 1980s that was given to me by another mudlark, and it's one of my most precious objects. But I love those little money box knobs. I've got the coins that went in the money boxes, the hammered coins. So I've got coins from most of the reigns of the Tudor monarchs. My rarest one is one from Mary and Philip. It's a shilling that I found. And obviously she didn't reign for very long, and they're quite rare. So that's probably, I'm not a big coin person. Coins, that it's great finding them, but they really do what they say on the box. You know, there's not, for me, there's not a great deal of huge interest in them. I like the more personal objects. But I've got coins from, you know, Henry and Elizabeth and Mary, and, you know, I have got some lovely Tudor book clasps that would have gone on books there. I've got a good collection of those. Goodness knows how they ended up in the river. I mean, one of the reason we find so much is things were gathered, you know, things were swept up and thrown into the river, cartloads of rubbish. But also the foreshore was a working environment and it was well looked after. So in the 18th and 19th centuries particularly, they would bring rubbish and spoil from digging into the land further in, and they'd bring it down and they'd dump it on the foreshore and pack it down and cover it with chalk and make it flat so that the barges could rest on it at low tide and unload at the riverside. And what's happened is, since the ships and the barges stopped coming in the 60s and 70s, the foreshore has been completely neglected, and the wooden revetments that held all this rubbish in have rotted away, and the river has started reclaim all this rubbish that was used to pack up and flatten out the foreshore. So it's eating away at it and eroding it. And it's this erosion that's creating these fantastic finds, which is why you'll find something Tudor lying next to something Roman, because often when they dug into the, maybe in the city, they were digging down to make a cellar for a new house. They were digging down into the medieval and Roman layers and taking that spoil and dumping it on the foreshore. So that's one reason. There's no real layers on the foreshore. It's all just a mess of history. Going back to my Tudor finds, but the Bellarmine faces are lovely, from the Bellarmine bottles that they date back into the 16th century, and they came from Germany. They're German stoneware bottles with little round pot bellies and the face of a bearded man on them, and it's this face of the bearded man that all mudlarks are looking for, because you find lots of shards of this sort of tiger-like salt glaze, but it's the faces with these beards and these sort of grotesque, gurning faces that we're all looking for. And these were imported from the Netherlands and from the Rhineland, and some were imported empty, some were imported with the sweet wine in them, and they were used in taverns and homes to keep ale and wine in. And it's said that this face, which actually represents the wild man, which is a common sort of in folklore in Europe, that it's said that this face resembled a cardinal called Cardinal Bellarmine. He was he was an Italian cardinal who was staunchly Catholic, staunchly anti-alcohol, at a time when the Protestants and Catholics were fighting it out. And it's said that people in England like to smash these bottles to see the cardinal's face in pieces, and that's why there's so many shattered Bellarmines on the foreshore. And I don't know if that's true or if that's urban myth, but it's quite nice.
It's a good story.
But I do love it. Is I love seeing those little faces just looking back at me from the foreshore. I mean, other things I like finding are, I've got a beautiful silver bodkin with an ear scoop on the end of it, with someone's initials SE on it. So anything with initials or anything personal like that is what I really love looking for. I've got that ear scoop. I've got another little Tudor medieval ear scoop as well, made of wire. And I've got a little early Tudor medieval nail scraper. But there's one place on the foreshore that's really Tudor. It's at Greenwich, because that's where Henry VIII's palace was, Greenwich Palace, which has now gone, which was knocked down during the English Civil War because it had fallen into such a state of disrepair. And if you go to the foreshore there, it's not so good now, but when I first started mudlarking, it was fabulous. And you could go there and you could find all around, there's the old Elizabethan bricks, the very thin ones, and the tiles from the roofs, and even some dressed stone and carved stone from the actual palace itself. But in amongst that was the pottery, the broken pottery from the kitchens. And if you look really carefully, you could find the bones of the animals that they ate, and the hazelnut shells, and even the reeds from the floor that are so perfectly preserved that when they wash out, and that instant that they're first washed out, they're as perfect as the day they dropped in, but they very quickly wash away and dissolve. And you can also, I've also found some tiny, tiny little pipe bowls that date back to about 1580, and they're the earliest pipe bowls you can find. And they're as small as the end of my little finger. And they date back to 1850, when Walter Raleigh first brought tobacco over from the New World and introduced it to London. It's said that Elizabeth I tried it and didn't really like it. And it was very, very expensive, became quickly very fashionable. Everyone thought it was good for you. And it was very cool to be seen with a pipe in your face. And it caught on incredibly quickly. So the people in the colonies started to grow more tobacco and ship more over, and it got cheaper. And the pipe bowls got larger. And that's how you date pipe bowls, by their size. And so by the mid 1700s, they were much larger. But pipes are one of the most common things you can find on the foreshore. And I've only found a few of these little tiny Tudor pipes that were known as fairy pipes, because when people found them in the sort of 18th, 19th century, they were so small that they thought that they were pipes smoked by the fairies and elves. So that's why they're called fairy pipes. So really, you know, that's the short version of my favourite.
It's incredible. It's so incredible. And it just really brings the history to life. I imagine when you're holding something like that, you know, you may have read about the tobacco coming to England, but holding one of those pipes, that just makes it all so real, doesn't it?
It is, because very often they've still, you can see they're black inside from the last time they were smoked. And it's that feeling of, with everything that I find on the foreshore, it's that knowledge that you're the first person to pick it up, since the person who dropped it or lost it or threw it away last touched it. You're the first person. It is the closest thing. It's like reaching back through time and shaking hands with history. It really is time travel. It's incredible. It sends shivers up my spine sometimes, you know, especially with the more personal objects. It's really quite amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. Now, you mentioned earlier that, you know, that you discovered the skull and the box of ashes. Are there any other sort of curious items that you found during your mudlarking?
The weird and wonderful things. I found spells and curses. Oh. People throw things into the river because they think that they're just going to disappear. They don't think that they will wash up or that there are people like me scavenging around under the bridges. So, you know, mudlarks find engagement rings and wedding rings that have been thrown off bridges, love letters, torn up photographs, messages in bottles. I've found machetes and knuckle dusters, the chamber of a gun with the bullets still in it. All of those sort of illegal things that go in the river as well. Stolen property, empty, loads of empty wallets, bag, credit cards, you name it. People throw everything in the river. And they have done through the whole of history. I've found a coin with somebody's name and date on it, which was probably a love token. I've found a Tudor posy ring. There's another good Tudor find.
I love those.
That's one of my favourite finds. And it's silver and it's got written inside. When I found it, it was black with tarnish. I couldn't see anything on it. I thought it was just an ordinary ring. But when I got it home and cleaned it up, I could see inside written, "I live in hope." Aww. And it's quite big. It's a man's ring, I think, or a very big woman. And because it's made of a precious metal and it's over 300 years old, I was legally obliged to report it as treasure. Mm-hmm. So I took it to the museum and they looked at it and they found one almost exactly the same in the British Museum's collection. And so they could date it to the 16th century and also from the style of the writing and the fact that it was in English and not in French, because the earlier ones are usually in French. And that was really special. And just sliding that ring on, really felt quite eerie, actually. I feel strange wearing it. I don't wear it because it just feels too weird. I wear it on a chain around my neck sometimes, but I can't wear it on my finger. It just feels too personal. So that was beautiful. But and also little bent sixpences, which was, it was the fashion to bend a sixpence into an S shape and to present it to your intended instead of a ring. And if she liked you, keep it, she'd keep it. If she didn't, loads of them have ended up in the river, because I found about 7 of them. So, and my oldest one dates back to, it's an Elizabethan coin that's been bent into an S shape. Those are special, those are precious too.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's like a tapestry of all these stories, isn't it? All these lives and stories all intertwined, and it's just mind-boggling. Amazing.
It is and it's just that you can let your imagination go. It's nobody knows if it's right and nobody knows if it's wrong. And you know, I'm not a historian, I'm not an archaeologist, you know, I research as much as I can, and a lot of it nobody knows. So you're free to make it up, which I love. You can just invent these lives around these pieces that you find, which I love doing.
Yeah. Have you ever found yourself in a bit of a like a research rabbit hole where you found something and you just are desperate to know, you know, more about it?
Yes. Yes. And I mean, some things you can just research and research and research. The little coin I found that it's got someone's name on it and the date, J. Tweedy, and the date, I think it's 1820. And somebody on my Facebook page has gone away and actually found a J. Tweedy who would have been around in the area that I found it in around that time. And you know, we'll never know if it was the J. Tweedy, but it's likely it could have been. So you know, you can just keep, once you sort of open those doors and like you say fall down the rabbit hole, you can just keep going forever and ever. It's a labyrinth, isn't it? You know, then you find something else that's fascinating to read about and something else that's fascinating. You know, by the end of the night my eyes are bleeding.
Yeah. Definitely. Now, it sounds like you could open your own museum, Lara. So what do you do with the objects that you find?
I curate my collection quite carefully. I'm not a sort of mad collector with, I don't take everything home. I leave quite a lot on the foreshore if I've already got it. I give quite a lot away to various smaller museums. I give whatever the Museum of London wants, I give it to them. And the things that I keep them if they're a good example or I don't already have it. And I tend to keep things small because I like to look close up. So the things that I find are usually quite small. So I keep them all in a big printer's chest. It's got 18 drawers, little thin drawers, all divided up for the old print type. And that works perfectly. So I've lined the drawers with different colour felt. And I keep most of my stuff in there. I've got a few display cases and I've got a couple of larger things on shelves around the house. But it's mostly, if it'll fit in the printer's chest, it gets to stay.
Many of the artefacts, and I've seen some pictures of things that you've found and that you've posted, they look like they were kind of lost yesterday. So how is it that they're so well preserved?
Well, they do. And I was actually saving my, I wasn't sure if you can ask me what my favourite find is, because everyone asks me, what's your favorite find? So what's my favorite find? I'm going to get it in now because I can talk about preservation as well.
Yes.
With it. So my favourite find is actually a Tudor find, and it is a child's it's a child's Tudor shoe, and it is amazing. It's about the size, it would have fitted my son when he was about 5, and it's just a little slip-on shoe. The back's been pushed down by the, you know, it's just been slip-on, so the back's pushed down, and I pulled it out of the mud absolutely perfect, as if it had fallen off this child's foot yesterday. The cord that would have held it together had rotted away, but the leather, partly because the leather's already partially preserved anyway, it's tanned, was perfect condition. It was just this little brown shoe that came out, and I could see all the little lines across the top, and whoever had worn it had worn a hole in the end with their toes, so they'd obviously grown out of it. And I could see just this faint shadow of a footprint inside the toes and the heel. And it was just magical. And one reason that this, well, the reason that objects like this are so perfectly preserved by the Thames is because the Thames is anaerobic, which means there's no oxygen in the mud, so that if something's perfectly encased in the mud, it'll stay like that until it reaches the fresh air again. Once it's out of there, wood and the reeds from the floor and nuts and things like that, they very quickly get soft and soggy and wash away and dissolve. And so with this little shoe, the race was on, really, just to preserve it. And I took it to the Museum of London to see if they would conserve it for me. But we're so spoiled in London. We have so much stuff, and they have so many shoes in their collection, and they just don't have the budget to help with all of them. They couldn't help me. So I took it to the Mary Rose, Henry VIII's, you know, ship. I took it down there to talk to the conservator down there, and he looked at it, he loved it. He said they haven't got any money either. And they have actually in their collection got exactly the same shoes, okay, but for grown-ups, so bigger ones. But he had studied at the University of Cardiff, and he suggested that I contact them, so I did. And they took it in, and they gave it to one of their students, and she worked on it, and she did a beautiful job. So the shoe's been conserved. It took me 2 years to actually get it done. And it's also taught one of the new conservators some really valuable skills. And she's now working as a full-time marine archaeologist. She specializes in waterlogged objects. And this is my best find. It really is. It's just such a lovely piece. And that's why things are so beautifully preserved. And that's why I'm so against people digging into the foreshore, because there is a permit that a limited number of people can get that allows them to dig nearly 5 foot down into the foreshore. And as far as I'm concerned, if something is that deep, it's safe. You know, it's preserved by the mud. It's been there for, you know, up to 2,000 years. Mm. It hasn't gone anywhere. It's going to be fine. And if you're smashing down through the mud with shovels and then madly detecting what you can before the tide comes in and covers everything up, you're going to miss so much. You're going to miss all the things that aren't made of metal. You're going to smash through delicate objects, and you're destabilizing the foreshore, because then once you've smashed down through this hard layer, it's soft, and the river can then start to eat away so much faster at it. So you're increasing erosion, and it's finite. What's in the river is going to run out. The river will eventually reclaim everything. And so to hasten that, it just seems to me ludicrous for anyone to do that.
Yeah, I agree with you. And judging by all the things that you've found, just by looking, there's really no need for it, is there? And when the river has a gift, it will deliver its gift, I think. So I agree with you totally. You mentioned that a permit's needed, definitely. Are there any other sort of regulations in place to protect the foreshore and all the treasure?
When you're on the foreshore, you're on private property. That's why you need a permit. It belongs to the Port of London Authority. The river doesn't belong to anyone itself, but the foreshore, the riverbed, does. And they have brought into, they've clarified the rules recently. Anybody going down onto the foreshore with the intention of searching needs to have a permit. And that's to protect what's down there. It's a finite amount of stuff. They don't want people going down there willy-nilly, taking stuff, using it as a takeaway for eBay, selling things. So it does put in a series of rules and legal rules that you have to abide by. There are areas like Queen Hyde Dock that are so protected, it's as protected as Stonehenge. You can't go in there, you can't take anything away. So there are maps that tell you where you can go and you can't go. If you find something of historic importance, according to the rules, you have to report it to a finds liaison officer, or the Museum of London. Now, finds liaison officers work for the Portable Antiquities Scheme, which is a project that is recording all the things that are being found in England, Britain's rivers and beaches and fields, because there's so much more metal detecting now. There's so much is being found. We need a way of recording what's being found. And so if you report it to your FLO, it'll be recorded on there. And they've recorded now well over 1 million objects. And that's so important, to record what's being found. If you come from abroad, you have to have an export license to take things back with you. We're really quite relaxed with our rules compared to most countries, but it's important to abide by the rules. It is our heritage. It's not, you know, it's not just there for the looting. And as I say, with treasure, if it's made of, simply put, it's a bit more complicated, but simply put, if it's precious metal and it's over 300 years old and it's not a single coin, it has to be legally reported as treasure. And then it goes through the whole treasure trove process and it's offered to museums if they want to buy it. If they buy it, then the finder gets half the value and the landowner gets half the value, or you can opt to donate it.
Okay, and I imagine now that there might be some people thinking, I might like to give this mudlarking a go. So do you recommend that, do people join with an experienced person, or do they just go down there once they've applied for a permit? How does that work?
You can go down. If you have a permit, you can go down. Obviously, it can be dangerous down there. It's slippery. Yeah. There are areas of deep mud, depending where you are. The tide can come back in quite quickly and cut you off. So dress sensibly, sunscreen, hat, decent boots, take a mobile phone, go with someone else, tell people where you're going. If you're nervous to do it yourself, then there are organisations. There's only two organisations with permission to do tours on the river.
Okay.
Make sure you go with one of them. One is Thames Discovery Programme and one is the Thames Explorer Trust, and they both have websites. The Thames Explorer Trust can put together a bespoke tour for you. If you go with either of those organisations on one of their tours, you won't need a permit. You can use theirs, but you won't be able to take away the things that you find.
All right, noting those down so I can add links for anyone that's interested. Myself, maybe one day. So I don't even think I need to ask this, Lara, but because I think I know, but why has mudlarking kept you captive for so long? What is it that you love about it?
Do you know, I think apart from the objects that I found, it's the peace that and quiet in the middle of the city that's kept me going for so long. It's been my place for sanity, just to detox from the city. London is just crazy, and it's getting crazier and more busy. Maybe I'm just getting older, but it really is another world down there. And it's just being able to check out of everyday life, go down there even for 20 minutes and just relax, and to be with the ghosts of the past, and to just let your imagination go. And you will find something, however small. And just the knowledge that all these people have been there before you, and that just ordinary everyday Londoners and London life is just there under your feet, waiting to be discovered. And you never know what you're going to find next. It just keeps me coming back.
Love it, love it. Now, we're up to that time of the episode where we play a little game that I call 10 to go. So it's 10 just sort of random-y questions to get to know you a little bit better. So are you ready, Lara?
Yeah, okay.
Number one, name two items that are on your bucket list. If you have a bucket list, that is.
Yes, I do. And that's very easy. I was talking about this yesterday, actually. Number one, I want to find a bone skate, because the Thames used to freeze over, because when the old bridge was there and it blocked the flow, it would slow down so much that the Thames froze over and they have frost fairs. So I'd love to find a bone skate that I could just some evidence of these amazing frost fairs, that if I could travel in time, I'd love to have gone back and just taken part in one. So a bone skate. And also, I would love to find a medieval pilgrim badge, which is a little bit earlier than Tudor, because old Henry VIII really starts sort of, he was the death knell on all of that sort of stuff. So I'd love to find Thomas Becket medieval pilgrim badge. And I have only found bits of pilgrim badges so far. So a complete one of those would be on my bucket list.
And what was the last film that you watched?
Oh, my goodness. I haven't watched a film for so long. I've been so busy. The last film I watched was, oh no, it's shameful. It was, I went with my kids to see the Toy Story, the latest Toy Story one. Yeah. Sorry, that's what it was.
No, that's
yeah,
okay.
It was nothing exciting.
That's all right. That's good. I like those movies. They're good. What's a favourite childhood memory of yours?
I grew up on a farm and I spent loads of time on my own, and I would spend hours in the fields and just playing by the river that went along the back of the house. And that's, I think, probably where I fell in love with rivers. And my childhood memories of being on the river and just watching, just sitting by it and fishing and watching the grass snakes swim up and down it and the water voles plopping into the water. And that those are my childhood memories, I think.
Yeah, that sounds lovely. All that freedom. How beautiful. Now, I know you like to walk, obviously, on the foreshore to unwind and relax. Is there anything else you do to kind of recharge the batteries?
My time is greatly limited. I have 7-year-old twins.
Wow.
So when I'm not down by the river, I'm fully immersed in family life and work. I think probably reading. Reading is my other checking out. I do quite a lot of reading. That is reading.
And that links very nicely with my next question. What's a book that's currently on your to-be-read list or that you're currently reading at the moment?
I'm currently reading Bird Cottage. I haven't got it in front of me. And I can't remember who wrote it, but it is a beautiful book about a woman who devoted her life to birds and worked in London and then bought a cottage just outside London and wrote about the birds, but she studied them in such detail. She knew each bird in her garden by name and by character. And the person who's written this has sort of written, it's a sort of hybrid of fiction and fact. So she sort of goes between sort of this woman's life that she's sort of imagining how this woman lived and her story behind it and what she actually did from this woman's notes and journals and memoirs. And it's beautiful. It's a beautiful book. I'm really, really enjoying it. Although, there again, I haven't had much time to read it at the moment.
That sounds lovely. Really lovely. I haven't heard of that one before. What's your ideal Saturday night?
My ideal Saturday night is binge watching something from iPlayer or Netflix. So I've been actually, although I don't watch that many films, I do binge watch those sort of things. So I have been binge watching Fleabag and Killing Eve recently and really enjoying them.
That sounds good. I haven't watched either. I'm so terrible with these things. I'm always late to everything. Like, the only thing I watched with everyone else was Game of Thrones. That's the only thing
yes.
that I...
But it was so disappointing, wasn't it, the ending?
Oh, yeah, look, it's not... I wasn't too happy with
let's
that
not
ending.
Let's not get into
that. We'll get really distracted.
Let's not go there.
And I was chatting to Dr. Susanna Lipscomb earlier in the week, and we were talking about how she's the same. She kind of binge-watches things years later. And I was saying that I only just finished Peaky Blinders. Like, I'm...
Peaky Blinders. I love Peaky Blinders. Yeah. They've got new season coming up, so I'll be binge-watching that as well.
I absolutely loved it. I watched 4 seasons in... Yeah, I don't even want to say in how long, because you'll think, what, does she do anything else? But I absolutely loved it. It was fantastic. Anyway, back to your questions. What is a favourite holiday destination?
My favourite holiday... I love Southeast Asia. I love Southeast Asia because it's just so different to here. I like going anywhere that's completely different to here. I've done quite a lot of travelling, and I can honestly say... anywhere in Southeast Asia. And I'm not a beach sitter at all. I can't sit on beaches. I get too fidgety and bored. So just I love exploring, and take me to Southeast Asia. Although Mongolia is on my list, my next place to go to.
Now, what's your favourite comfort food?
My favourite comfort food is Vietnamese food.
Yeah.
I could eat that until it's coming up my ears. I love it. So that's my favourite comfort food.
Now, you actually answered this question, but so I was going to ask you if you could travel back in time to see one event, and you've said that you'd want to see one of the frost fairs.
Yes, I would. I would not like to live in the past.
No.
I would love to be able to dip back in and out and be able to come back here for my painkillers and my toothbrush. I would not want to live in the past. It was painful and short and brutal, but I would love to be able to dip back here if I could have something that could just... I could just nip back into the past. I'd love to, so many people I'd love to see and meet and things I'd like to see. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you could just observe, I always think just an observe. I don't want to actually have to interact really, but observe would be really cool. Lucky, last question. What would you like to see more of in the world?
I want the world to slow down.
Yeah.
I want everyone just to stop and just put the gadgets down and take time to look around them. Everyone's lost the ability to look and to slow down, and it's so important. And I think that's one reason that there's such an issue with mental health at the moment. The world is spinning out of control. Children have got these gadgets. We're trying to do 5 things at once, and people need to learn to switch off and stop. And I think I'd like to see more of that. I'd like to see the world slow down, and I'd like to see people go back to the days before the gadgets.
I know, and I think that's part of, you know, mine, definitely, my fascination with the past. I just, yeah, as you say, everything's going so quickly at the moment, it feels a little bit out of control. So yeah, totally agree with you. Now, the very last thing, Lara, the way we end all our Talking Tudors episodes is I ask my guests for a Tudor takeaway. So something that we might be able to explore after the episode. Do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
I do. Okay, my Tudor takeaway is I grew up in a Tudor farmhouse. It was built in the reign of Henry the Eighth, and I loved that house. There was just, you could really feel the people that had lived there. And one of the things that obsessed me were the initials that people had carved on the fireplace. And whenever I go somewhere old, I look for initials and I look for things that people have carved. If you go to an old church, quite often you'll find all this old graffiti that people have carved with the dates, and it goes way back. And I just love the fact that people have been doing this for years and years and years. And then I discovered these things called witch marks, and they're actually called, I'll try and say it, apotropaic marks. Mm-hmm. And if you look on fireplaces of Tudor houses, you we'll sometimes see these circles that are sometimes overlapped into a kind of daisy shape. And they're always, almost always on fireplaces or near windows or doorways. And in Tudor times, people believed that was how witches got into houses, down the chimney or through the door or through the window. And they'd put these marks. They were sometimes pentangles, sometimes they were AM for Ava Maria, sometimes just an M for Mary or a W for Virgin of Virgins or the M and the W together, and sometimes these circles. And whenever I go to an old place, I always look for these little marks around the fireplace. And it's amazing how many times you'll find them. And sometimes they're in the beams, but it's around the fireplaces I look for them. And they just fascinate me. And I did also find out that the Bellarmines that we talked about earlier, people would use them as witch bottles. So they'd put spells inside them. Mm-hmm. And it was often urine and nail clippings and pins and things like that. And they found them in the doorways of old houses. And I discovered that they were actually not spells, bad spells, but they were protective spells against witches. So they'd bury these Bellarmines in the doorways or put them up the chimney to keep the witches out. And I think that a couple have been found in the river, and they were probably, you know, in rubble, in builder's rubble from something that had been knocked down and dumped in the river. And so they're sort of along the same lines. But this obsession with witches and sort of keeping the bad spirits away, and the fact that all these marks have sort of been handed down through history, and that you can find them so easily in old houses. So if you go into an old house, if you come to England, you're looking around old houses, look for these little signs on the carved into the fireplaces. And they have a fascinating background.
What a fantastic takeaway. We've never had that one before, so thank you so much. I think you've just sent me down another, you know, rabbit hole, by the way.
Yes,
I'm just
I have.
I'm gonna be Googling all these things now, that crazy lady. Lara, you are a woman after my own heart, there's no doubt. Thank you so much for taking the time in these really busy weeks with you at the release of your book, which is so fantastic, to chat and talk Tudors with us. Thank you.
You're more than welcome. And yeah, I hope you enjoyed my book when it arrives.
Can't wait. So that postman better get here soon, that's for sure.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.